and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 24th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, our theme was Off the Hill, Mind the Gap, the Federal Budget and Income Inequality. The federal budget for 2023 is soon to be announced. Who decides the budget? Who influences it? And where does all that money go? Last year's budget was aimed at growing the economy in Canada and making life more affordable and equitable. But did it? Our guests dissected these questions and more in our Off the Hill panel this week. Our March panel included MP Nikki Ashton, Chuka Ejekam, David MacDonald, and Carl Nirenberg, hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
As mentioned, this month we'll be discussing this year's upcoming federal budget. So to kick things off, a question for all of our panelists this evening. The theme of tonight's discussion here on Rabble is Mind the Gap, the federal budget and income inequality. So the question to all of you is, what does this budget need to have to make real strides in addressing income inequality? And why don't we start off with you, Nikki? Because I know you've got lots to say on this.
Oh, where to begin? I think in short, what we need is a budget that puts people ahead of profit. We know that the pandemic has only exacerbated inequalities that were already growing in our country. And we need a federal budget that has some clear investments in people to lift people up. You know, we're certainly pushing for more investment in dental care. There needs to be massive investment in housing, particularly in Indigenous housing, something that deeply affects the region that I represent. We also need to see key investments beyond that, and that includes in income supports. You know, I recognize as well, you know, we're talking, we just had a damning report on how serious the climate emergency is. So we're looking for some serious investments. And if I can say, as for profit, we know that, and I'm sure David's going to touch on this, we know corporations and the rich and powerful in our country have been making record profits. And we're certainly hoping that this budget, that finally the Liberals will break away from their friends and bring in some tax fairness and ensuring that the rich are paying their fair share. So we're looking forward to I hope, all of that.
Well, that's a good segue over to David. So thank you, Nikki. And David, you've followed many a federal budget. And from your point of view, in terms of the theme of Mind the Gap and income inequality, what is it that you're looking for that really needs to be in this budget?
Well, I mean, there are some things that would make a big difference. I'm not sure we'll see them. But, you know, I think some of the things that are quite active, files that are quite active, are EI reform. We've just gone through a big process of EI reform. I think that CERB and the pandemic experience showed us that we can have much better jobless benefits than we've had historically in this country. We can have easier access to employment insurance. We can have better access for gig workers and self-employed. We can have higher benefit levels that have a floor on benefits. These were all features of the CERB system. We've already seen it in action. It's not some hypothetical thing that's out there in the distant future that we're imagining. It's something that we saw. Unfortunately, we're looking at it now in the rearview mirror. I don't expect that we'll see anything on this front, but you know, this is one of the ways that you know, we could see lower income inequality would be better access for the jobless to these types of benefits. I mean, I should say that the pandemic response in 2020 cratered poverty rates. I mean, we achieved the poverty reduction goals that we set, you know, that were supposed to happen 5 and 10 years from now. We achieved them last year, or we achieved them, sorry, in 2020. So it just goes to show that major federal government investment can make huge strides in reducing poverty. Of course, the trouble is that when the 2021 data comes in, all those poverty rates will go right back up again because all those programs expired. But It's not to say that we didn't do it. It's absolutely possible. Mm-hmm. We can do it 10 years ahead of time if we want to. It's a matter of political will and, you know, ranking of political priorities as opposed to whether it can be done. In terms of some other pieces, we've had in our alternative budget, the Canada Disability Benefit is something that we've modeled in our alternative budget. And it's something that seems to be of interest to this government, although it's hasn't been discussed that much recently. It can have a big impact on poverty rates for folks with disabilities. And, it, you know, in terms of better supporting people in their working ages through a livable income or extending some of the seniors' benefits down to folks that are slightly younger, these would make big differences in terms of inequality. On the taxation front, you know, Nikki's quite right. I think that the surtax on the banks sets potentially, you know, this sets potentially an example for what could happen outside of the banks. The banks are one of four sectors that were major beneficiaries of inflation dollars. You want to know where that inflation money is going? It's not evaporating. It's going into somebody's pockets. 47 cents of every inflation dollar that you are spending, or that we are all spending in the Canadian economy, are going to four industries: oil and gas extraction, oil and gas refining, banks, and real estate. Well, there's a pandemic surtax on one of those four groups. It's banks. They're among the smallest. The biggest, frankly, is oil and gas and refining. It would be great if this the corporate income tax surtax was applied not just to banks, but more broadly to really capture all this money that's gone to profits instead of to productive investment in the economy.
Well, I think that gives us a really good reality check, David. So thanks for that. And let's hear from Chuka, just your initial thoughts on the federal budget and income inequality and what you think needs to be addressed.
And yeah, well, I do want to say quickly, if you were to name the four industries of the apocalypse, I don't think that the four that you just mentioned, David, would be the exact four, but I think they would be pretty good contesters. I would say that for the budget to address income inequality, it has to address wealth inequality. Wealthy people and people with very high incomes, they control what appears on their income sheets. There's an entire industry built around this called tax avoidance. So I would argue that in addition to measures to address income inequality, addressing wealth inequality itself, in addition, will help to address the overarching system of economic inequality, which defines our lives. And I think sort of in alignment with that, another measure would be decreasing the cost of household expenses by increasing the public provision of goods and services. This can be in familiar areas like public health, but it can also be moving toward more radical things like decommodifying housing and food, things that are absolutely essential that people will die if they do not have access to, but nonetheless, we allow people to profit from. So yeah, I would argue that those are two areas that that are ripe for action.
Absolutely. Thanks for that, Chuka. And Carl, just a quick comment from you in terms of what you're thinking in terms of what needs to be in a budget regarding income inequality.
So one thing we have to recognize that in Canada, a lot of the responsibility for dealing with the question of income inequality or wealth inequality is at the provincial level, a huge amount. Services, education, health, the management of real estate, of local transit, local environment, all that is a provincial responsibility. And so a federal government has to act in such a way as to force sometimes provinces' hands or work in partnership with provinces to achieve these social goals. I mean, housing, I would say, is one really great area. We have Ontario proceeding with a theoretical housing policy that's very skewed towards a policy favoring essentially the development and real estate industry and not necessarily the people who need housing, especially who need rental housing. And the federal government intervened a little bit because they were the provincial government of Ontario wanted to take over environmentally fragile territory, and the federal government is going to block them for at least part of that territory where the federal government has a say. But the federal government has to find a subtle way to move more strongly into the whole area of housing is one particular area. I think the idea of a wealth tax also, I think, is long overdue in Canada. And I think the other thing you have to look at, and I don't know, David would agree with me or not, probably would and to some extent, is the corporate tax rate, which is too low in Canada, as well as the fact that huge numbers of wealthy people use the fact that it can constitute themselves as corporations of one sort or the other to avoid tax. So tax avoidance is an enormous and complicated problem. And working with the provinces is another complicated problem. We have a complicated country, but I think if you have a determined federal government, it can make progress.
Thanks, Carl. And I'm sure we'll come back to the issue of the corporate tax rate and tax evasion, but I just want to kind of switch gears briefly and go back to David and sort of dig a little bit into what's behind the budget. And, you know, it's for most people, yeah, the government announces a budget, they table it in Parliament, it gets debated. But I guess an interesting question is who outside of the government, who really has the power to influence what's in the budget? Where does that come from? So any thoughts, David, that you have on that in terms of what happens behind the scenes in terms of, mega influences and lobbying that shapes that federal budget outside of the government itself?
I wish I knew who had the power to give them a call. I don't know that much about lobbying. Clearly, if you can go meet with ministers, you can advocate for these sorts of things. Often people who are seen as neutral are not at all neutral, right? I mean, the mm-hmm. bank economists aren't neutral. They have a vested interest in particular policies. Lawyers who are advocating for particular things are often not at all neutral. They set up corporate evasion schemes, and then they argue the corporate evasion schemes cancellation would be terrible for their clients. That's not neutral at all. I think, on a more positive perspective, how do you get things into a budget? Working for a think tank, it's not entirely clear what the route is, how you get things into budgets. It certainly helps to have, one of the features of budgets is they are presenting a set of ideas. Those ideas are costed ideas. So they're specific enough to be costed, and they have the price tag attached. And that's why they're in a budget. And that's how federal and provincial budgets work. It's these little bits and pieces of additions to programs or subtractions to programs or changes in existing programs. And so to get things into budgets, you need a costed proposal. You can't just say, we need to reduce poverty. Well, that's not specific. It doesn't have a price tag. It doesn't have a year-by-year breakdown. That might be you might want to start with that as an idea. And then how do you reduce it? Oh, you're going to change this particular program in a particular way, and this is how much it's going to cost, and so on. And so the more you can get down to specific proposals that are costed, I think the more likely it is to get things into budgets. Certainly in election years, it's often a lot easier to get things into election platforms than it is to get things into election budgets, particularly for opposition parties. Because they're looking for ideas and they don't have the levers of power. Once you're in power, then you've got access to finance. You can rhyme off a bunch of ideas and a bunch of people will go off and cost those ideas and refine them and send them back to you, and then you can put them in the budget. You have a lot less of that ability outside of government. But the alternative federal budget is a way that we try to bring together progressive groups and work through the process of, you want something specific, great. That's not specific enough. How do we get some costing on it? What's it going to cost in the first year, second year, third year? In an attempt to get, a bit of a laundry list that people could choose from if you happen to be in government and you wanted an idea. I mean, the other thing too, right, is, I mean, it's not as if people in government even necessarily know what's going to be in the budget. Ministers of various programs submit ideas, and those go to cabinet and they go to finance, and they find out just like everybody else on budget day whether the idea that they had made it into the budget and they've got to execute on it or not. And so, it's a very concentrated group that decides in the end what is the list of individual cost items that make it into the budget. And that's not even necessarily decided until probably about 2 weeks before the budget's announced, because they have to sort of go through the printing process and so on. So, everyone says, I know the budget's going to be this time. I know this is going to be in it. That's not going to be in it. That's just not true at all. I mean, these things change all the way up to the last couple of weeks before the budget. Mm-hmm. And so it's a much more flexible process, I think, maybe than people understand. And it's possible to influence. But you never know when the influence is going to be or where it's going to come from. And so that's why it's always good to have a decent list of ideas on hand that are costed and pretty specific.
So, Nikki, So the NDP has a supply and confidence agreement with the Liberals. So first, can you just kind of explain what that is to folks? Just a little brief description, and then talk about will that agreement affect the NDP support of the budget, and if so, how? Well, no, yeah.
Yes, well, absolutely. I mean, we are on the eve of a potentially, we hope, historic budget that will certainly have an NDP stamp on it. It's actually just We just passed the 1 year anniversary of signing this agreement with the Liberals, and are entering into this agreement, pardon me, with the Liberals. And it is supplying confidence motion or supplying confidence agreement, pardon me. And it really is based on supporting the government's agenda in particular. At particular junctures, based on obviously key priorities that we've agreed with them to move on. So dental care, for example, housing, federal anti-scab legislation, a Just Transition Act. There's various pieces to this agreement. Of course, you know, it's not a carte blanche that we're there to support the Liberals on everything, and we've certainly opposed them on various things, but on key votes like the budget, the expectation is that they will have lived up to what was in that agreement and what's evolved as part of that agreement, and that we in turn can actually support that. So I will say, I mean, like David said, we don't know exactly what's in there. Many Liberals don't know exactly what's in there, but we've certainly worked very hard as a team build and on what was initially agreed upon, apply pressure, bring in, you know, whether it's the labor movement, members and activists from other social movements, progressive economists and thinkers to say, look, you know, these are the things that we need to be prioritizing, and we've put so much effort in, and I know a number of our critics have played a lead role on all of these issues that that are seen as priorities at this moment in time, and I think we're hopeful, but there are some troubling signs. You know, I mean, obviously, no fan of the Liberals here. I am very troubled about their lack of commitment around tax fairness, right? I mean, we've seen record profits from the rich and powerful in our country, and extreme reticence from Chrystia Freeland and her crew there to rein them in, right? You know, we've been pushing for a windfall tax on key sectors, and we haven't seen movement the way other countries are moving. We've certainly pushed to close tax loopholes and to take tax evasion seriously. And this government is definitely not doing it. You know, there's been some cosmetic changes, you know, some important things, but by no means what we need to get a handle on the level of tax avoidance and tax evasion we're seeing in our country. And we think this is the time to do it, when profits are where we're seeing record profits, when Canadians are incensed that costs are only going up. I mean, just the fact that, you know, we know inflation has dropped a bit, and yet on food, it's almost double the national rate. You know, Canadians are saying, hey, wait a second, why am I paying my fair share? And meanwhile, all these folks in the grocery, banking, oil and gas and other profitable sectors getting away with ripping us all off. I'm not sure that I'm holding my breath here on that one, but it's clear that we're going to need to continue to apply serious pressure on the Liberals. And if I could just add as an asterisk, you know, certainly some of David's comments, I think we are in a also particularly interesting and frankly potentially dangerous moment in our political sort of journey here, where the conservatives, where Pierre Poilievre has taken on left-wing sort of class warfare discourse, hook, line, and sinker, really appealing to working class folks, to blue collar workers, including in parts of the country like mine, you know, to say that he's on your side. But when you scratch the surface to find out what that means, it is most definitely the opposite. I think we have to take the conservatives on. I think we have to be also very clear in opposing their rhetoric, based on the fact that we know they always push austerity, privatization, benefits for their rich friends, not unlike the Liberals in many cases. And so I think the Liberals are going to try and cower a bit to some of that pressure. We certainly can't let that happen. And when I mean we, I mean Canadians, progressives and Canadians overall. We have to call both the Liberals and the Conservatives out for their faux populism and right-wing politics.
So now just moving over to Chuka. Chuka, your global and anti-colonial perspective of Canadian politics, which we always love hearing about on Off the Hill panels, it's really a very important analysis of the upcoming budget. So a question for you.
A small segment from our most recent live panel, Off the Hill, Mind the Gap, the Federal Budget, and Income Inequality. Big thank you to our guests who appeared on this week's panel, and thank you to our brilliant audience members for their engaging questions. To watch the full panel, please visit rabble.ca/rabbletv or visit our YouTube channel. If you missed this month's event and don't want to miss the next one, be sure to sign up for email reminders for events such as this at rabble.ca/alerts. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll hand it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In Canadian politics, this week U.S. President Joe Biden visited our nation's capital. Prior to his visit, parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg criticized the U.S. president's decision to greenlight a controversial oil drilling project in Alaska. The project, hailed as the Willow Project, will have significant impacts on the environment and the livelihoods of Indigenous peoples in the adjacent territory of Canada's north. Specifically, the project will affect the lives of the Gwich'in people, who live in a handful of communities in northeast Alaska, the Yukon, and the Western Northwest Territories. Another group who lives on this land is the Porcupine Caribou. The Gwich'in people harvest this caribou sustainably, and, according to the Northern Caribou Canada Project, this population of caribou is currently doing well, because it can move through this vast range of over 200,000 square kilometers freely. All that will change once ConocoPhillips starts building roads and work camps, hauling in tons of heavy equipment, and constructing oil drilling platforms. Will President Biden's trip to Canada be enough to change his mind about this project? If not, Nirenberg writes, an entire way of life for the Gwich'in people and the Porcupine Caribou will be mortally threatened. Also in Canadian politics, columnist Monia Mazig shares findings from a recent study on Islamophobia in Canada, confirming what Muslim communities and activists have known for a long time. Canada needs a robust anti-Islamophobia strategy to ensure the safety of Muslims. According to the study, 2 in 5 Canadians outside of Quebec, or 39%, hold an unfavorable view of Islam. In Quebec, that number reaches 52%. When Canadians were asked whether the country has a problem with Islamophobia, Canadian respondents were evenly divided, with 50% saying it does, and 50% saying it does not. Interestingly, the study also found that those most likely to view Islam negatively, in Quebec and in the rest of Canada alike, were also the most likely to say there is no problem with Islamophobia. Mazig argues Islamophobia isn't a matter that Muslims alone should be involved in solving. It is a societal problem. She writes, quote, "In Canada, if we wish to seriously and effectively combat Islamophobia, we should work on multiple levels. Naming a special representative on combating Islamophobia is important, but shouldn't be the end of the road." End quote. Trigger warning. The next story deals with subjects of sexual violence. In international news, Rabble reporter Stephen Wenzel reports that in the years since the beginning of the hashtag MeToo movement, that sexual violence and violence against women remains a pervasive problem. Every 68 seconds, an act of sexualized violence occurs in the U.S. That's over 1,350 acts each and every day, and nearly 500,000 in any given year. Tarana Burke, a founder of the MeToo movement, spoke at the South by Southwest conference in Austin, Texas, on March 10th, and discussed the progress made so far and the work that still needs to be done. 5 years since Harvey Weinstein was exposed and thousands of women started speaking up, twice as many Americans now support the hashtag MeToo movement than oppose it. And many now believe that if there is someone who engages in sexual violence or harassment in the workplace, that they will be held accountable. However, many businesses and other brands are still hesitant to openly support the movement out of fear of seeming political. Burke concluded that rather than just being viewed as a women's movement, hashtag MeToo must be seen as a social justice and human rights issue. This week on World Water Day, labor reporter Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga shares CUPE's second annual Water is Life campaign. One of the big concerns for CUPE is the threat of privatization of water infrastructures. As a part of their campaign, they highlight how the privatization of water infrastructures perpetuates colonialism and threatens indigenous communities with hardship. As recently as 2020, the Algoma Central Corporation pleaded guilty to dumping contaminated water into Lake Ontario, and 28 indigenous communities in Canada still live under water advisories, requiring some to boil their water before use or rely on bottled water. Don Belrose, co-chair of the National Indigenous Council in CUPE, explained the dangers of water privatization by saying, quote, "Someone's making a profit off of our natural resources or things that should be publicly owned. People shouldn't be making money off of water. Water connects us all. We need it to live. We need it to survive." End quote. And finally, join Rabble for a very special book launch webinar next week as we discuss advocating for Palestine in Canada. Through the experiences of the contributing authors, Advocating for Palestine in Canada offers an indispensable and first-hand view into the complex social and historical forces at work in one of the world's most urgent issues, and one which also has huge implications for freedoms enjoyed by Canadians. This webinar will feature contributing authors from the book to share their unique views and wide experiences on advocating for Palestine in Canada, revealing a solid civil society movement in the face of strong institutional opposition. Our panelists share how they came to Palestine activism, why they continue, and where they see the movement going. Join us for this free event on Thursday, March 30th, 2023 at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Save your spot with a link in our show notes, or, for all of you listening on radio, find the link to this event on rabble.ca. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to the podcast. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It only takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.